Tight Lies by David Donaghy and read by Russell Bentley for Saga Egmont. Chapter 1. Most of New York was in bed when, after only 3 hours' sleep, Vice President Philip Beekman III got up to drink a coffee, shower, and shave for what might be the most important day in his life. Stretching, he winced slightly at the discomfort caused by the tiny, self-inflicted wound he'd made in his upper right arm. Not deep pain, but enough to remind him of what he was risking. It was no sneakers and tracksuit on this particular Sunday morning, no run to keep up the level of fitness he had maintained since his Delta Force days. He dressed in a sober suit and tie, as well as polished black slip-on shoes. Before the first hint of dawn hit the eastern sky, he drained the coffee and picked up the phone to alert Claude Teller, to signal to the selected members of his close protection team he was ready to depart. The trio of bodyguards, led by Teller, met him in the hallway at the front of the elevator, passing, as they descended to the basement, a dozen more Secret Service agents who'd been up all night guarding a presidential candidate, who also just happened to be the second most important person in the Republic. There was another detail in the basement, both as standard security and to guard the fleet of vehicles the Veep used for official functions, that he chose to bypass the armored Cadillac, known as the Beast, and make for the nondescript gray Ford Focus caused no comment. His team assumed he was off on yet another one of his clandestine jaunts. On the street outside, the barriers erected by the New York Police Department ensured anyone coming close posed no threat. Since it was leaving, not entering the secure area, those manning them paid scant attention to the car as it exited the underground garage. Inside, and from the rear seat, Phil Beekman gave quiet instructions to his driver, the car turning away from its eventual destination, and in the next 15 minutes, zigzagging through the deserted avenues of Midtown, the sky getting lighter to the east, until Claude Teller, sitting with him in the back, was sure they were not being followed. Only then did the vice president give the driver a route which would take him to his rendezvous in the business district of Lower Manhattan. By the time they made the junction of Exchange and Hanover, it was just light enough to see from one side of the street to the other. The first bullet shattered the windscreen and hit the driver in the center of his forehead, exploding immediately after contact with the glass, to form an expanding projectile which made mincemeat of his face and brain. The second bullet, like the first, took the agent sitting beside him in the side of the head, and the effect was the same. With both men dead, the car decelerated to the right and smashed into a fire hydrant. Black-clad figures emerged swiftly from the shadows, a magnetic stun grenade placed on the rear passenger door. Claude Teller died while his gun was only halfway out of his holster, shot in the head at point-blank range by an old-fashioned revolver. Used for its very low muzzle velocity, anything more powerful risked killing two people instead of one. Phil Beekman moved for the other door, which was ripped open as soon as he touched it, causing him to fall forward. The soft black sack was over his head in a second. The drawstring pulled tight. He was lifted under the armpits by two of his assailants and dragged across the tarmac. He didn't struggle. That was a part of the standard Special Forces training to which he had been subjected as a younger man. You had to know when resistance was useless, more dangerous than submission. The leader of the kidnap team, who had not moved from his start position, waited until their captive was thrown into the Chevy panel truck, followed by his captors and the trio of killers. When the door slammed shut, he pressed the stop button on his watch. The truck was already moving.